Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today in episode 156, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Jerry Bovino, one of the founders and former president of the American Society of Retinal Specialists. We take a deep historical dive to discuss the origins of ASRS and the controversy of its formation at the time. A list of financial disclosures are attached to this episode in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Jerry Bovino. Dr. Bovino was clinical professor of ophthalmology at the Medical College of Ohio and one of the founders and past presidents of the American Society of Retinal Specialists. Dr. Bovino, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
We ask the same question to all our new guests. First is, why did you decide to become an ophthalmologist and then a retinal specialist?
Okay, so I started out in internal medicine, did a straight medical internship, was quite certain I was going to become an internist, but I became frustrated with it. At the time, I was at Mount Sinai in New York, where Irving Leopold was the chairman of the Department of Ophthalmology. And I did a rotation through ophthalmology, and all the ophthalmologists seemed happy, and they seemed like they were smarter than the internist I was working with. And I said, this might not be a bad career change for me, and it was the best thing I ever did.
Yeah, you referenced when we were setting up this interview, you had an interesting experience when you interviewed at Bascom Palmer, which is where I am now. What's the story behind that? You said there was a funny story there.
Yeah, there is a funny story. So when I applied, I was first in my class in medical school, and I was, to be candid, probably a little bit overconfident about my ability to secure a residency in ophthalmology. And I applied to a couple of places, and I wasn't accepted anywhere. And at that time, it was very competitive for two reasons. You had to have completed your military obligation because it was during the Vietnam War. And there was a lot of nepotism in ophthalmology. There always has been. You know, your father, your grandfather, your uncle were all ophthalmologists, and those people seemed to get preference. And I didn't have any of those typical ophthalmologic family connections. So I had to do my military obligation before I could reapply. And I wound up doing public health service for 2 years as a lieutenant commander, taking care of gonorrhea and merchant seamen. And in the middle of my public service, Al Vern, who actually had wound up marrying my old girlfriend from medical school, Barbara, called me and said that Roosevelt Hospital teaching program, one of the Columbia affiliates, was increasing its program to two residents a year. And they called me in to interview, and Jim Newton was the chairman. I liked him, he liked me. And just by pure serendipity, I was able to secure a residency. But I did go to Bascom Palmer and interview. And when I got there, I met with Dr. Victor Curtin and Dr. Norton and Dr. McAmer. And Dr. McAmer asked me why I should be an ophthalmologist. And I said, I enjoy the academic part and I enjoy the medical part. And I think I'd be a competent surgeon. And he had me tie little knots on his finger with pen-o nylon, which was peculiar. But anyway, I wasn't accepted.
Well, That's a funny story. So what was your path like after that? So, you went on, you did your training, and then after fellowship, how did your career progress after that?
Yeah, I was a fellow in Iowa. And when you're in Iowa, you get recruited by all of the Midwest opportunities and wound up going to an excellent opportunity in Toledo, Ohio. And that's where I sort of built my practice and did whatever research I was able to do and worked at the medical college.
Let's talk about the origins of ASRS, which was originally the Vitreous Society. How did that come to be? And tell us some of the stories from the early days about the inception of the organization.
Yeah, it's a fascinating historical evolution. You have to date back to the 1960s when retina doctors basically just did scleral buckles. There wasn't much else for us to do in those days. And the Retina Society was formed by Dr. Charles Scapins in Boston, And it was a loose amalgamation of friends and contacts from Boston and a couple of cataract surgeons thrown in for good measure. And they were sort of limited in their size by their own statutes. And the Macular Society, which followed, was also quite restrictive. And when I became an attending after my fellowship, I wanted to go to these meetings, and I called the Retina Society and I said, look, you know, I know you don't take new members right now, but can I just sit in the back of the room? And they said, no, we don't really allow that. And I was enthusiastic about retina and our profession. So I told my wife how frustrated I was. And she said, well, who does the Retina Society? I said, that's Charles Scapins. Who does the Macular Society? That's Larry Singerman. And she said, who does the Vitreous Society? And a light went off in my head because there was no Vitreous Society at the time. In the late 1970s, vitrectomy was just evolving. And I met with Al Verne and Roy Levitt in Aspen at Poppy's Restaurant around 1980 or 1981, told them the story. And before you know it, we had formed the Vitreous Society, which became the precursor to the ASRS. But the differentiating point of the Vitreous Society is that we configured ourselves as an open, egalitarian, democratic society that did not limit its membership capriciously by personal contacts or papers or references. We were open to all retina specialists who wanted to work in a collegial environment and do optimal patient care.
So it's interesting, you referenced a couple times now how ophthalmology maybe wasn't as inclusive, and retina specifically as inclusive, you know, 30, 40 years ago is now. What sort of, did you get pushback? I mean, was this something that was well received by members, you know, the older members of the field or members of the Macular Society?
Au contraire, as we would say in French. They thought this was the worst idea that they had ever heard in their lives, because most of American ophthalmology was sort of configured on the European model, this top-down model where the professor decides what everybody under them can do. And that's sort of the way it evolved in retina in the 60s and 70s. So when we formed the Vitreous Society, which became the ASRS, the largest organization of retina specialists in the world, we were, to be candid, laughed at. Like, who are these guys? And actually, a few of the heads of the other societies called us individually and criticized us and actually asked, amazingly, who gave you permission to do this? And at the time, we looked at ourselves as the colonists rebelling against the king.
Yeah.
And we feel the ASRS is a distinctly American organization and that democracy always works. And the two things that I've learned, Jay, after a lifetime, a professional lifetime, is that we did two things differently in the American Society of Retina Specialists that other societies didn't do. First of all, we had respect for all of our colleagues, not just the ones that were in our organization. And second of all, we had respect for new ideas. And I'm a member of the Retina Society, a proud member of the Retina Society, and I've been to the meetings, and in the early days, people were, you know, nervous about trying to say anything that might evoke criticism. But way back, the first presentation by Kelly and Wendell of macular hole surgery back in the sort of mid to late 80s was at the American Society of Retina Specialists. And we received it well. We were curious about it. It sounded unbelievable. When it was later presented at the Academy meeting in New Orleans, it was panned by all the experts in our field who all turned out to be wrong. So respect for new ideas encourages new and innovative ideas.
Let's touch on that. Why do you think there is that resistance? I mean, this is true not just in medicine, but just in life. But do you think that resistance is true as a generational thing? Do you think that it was philosophical, that they felt that maybe things wouldn't be done properly? I mean, or how much of this, I mean, not to be cynical, but how much of this is purely political? I mean, that people just don't like the fact that maybe they don't have the same influence on an organization if they're not the leadership.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's an excellent question. I'm not sure I can answer it because the factors, you know, it's probably multifactorial, mm-hmm. probably all those things enter into it. But in medicine, you know, we get, historically, we tend to be at risk of getting trapped in old ways of doing things and old ideas. And anybody throughout history, not just in medicine, but throughout history, anybody who had a new idea, Galileo Galilei, you know, who might have observed that we're not the center of the universe, was criticized. And so we're, you know, inertia, a body at rest tends to remain at rest unless acted on by an outside force. And that outside force has to be very strong, especially in academia, where everybody is nervous about taking a risk that might prove them wrong.
How does the ARS risk kind of evolve? I mean, you've seen it grow and change over the last, you know, 35 plus years, nearly 40 now. And so how have you seen kind of the organization change? Obviously, it's much, the membership is much larger and it's grown to international prominence, not just domestic. And you served as president. So how have you kind of observed now that you're in emeritus status, the organization continues to grow?
Right. It's an interesting study in organizations and in human nature. I think there was a British lord named Lord Galsworthy who said the beginnings and endings of all human endeavors are untidy. And the beginning of the Vitreous Society, which was renamed the ASRS, was quite untidy. We were under nuclear attack from the organized bodies that had a lot more political clout than we did. We were the sort of the laughing stock of the other societies who couldn't stand the thought of being threatened by this new upstart society, very much like the colonists in America. And it was a very nervous time for us. I know I was nervous personally. Nobody wants to be an outlier. We all, to a certain extent, want to conform. And we all want, and this is a very important thing, Jay, we all want the recognition of our peers. And when the people that you respect in positions of authority in these other organizations criticize you, it's very hard to stand up for yourself. Fortunately for me, my mother always taught me two things. She said, always remember that you're not better than anybody, but always remember that nobody is better than you. Mm-hmm. And that was a thread that took me through the first tumultuous years of the Vitreous Society, that I thought we had every right to do this, that we were serving our profession and our patients. And I felt good about it. And, you know, you're not going to accomplish much if you're always worried about what other people say about you. There's another thing my father taught me. Nobody is as good or bad as what people say about them.
And how long do you think it took to get acceptance from the field at large and from the older kind of members of the field? Was it a 5-year period, a 10-year period? Was it, do you think it's,
well, it's an,
when did that happen?
So what happened was, over the first 5 or 10 years, we were sort of the outlier society, but we, Alan and Roy and I were the first presidents, and then we brought in new people better than us. It's a great lesson for anybody in any organization. And, you know, Harry Truman said, there's no limit to what you can accomplish if you're not worried about who gets the credit. And we brought in people better than us. Some of them had tremendous influence. Kirk Pacco is an example, who's one of my lifelong closest friends and one of the most talented people I know in our specialty, came in and he wasn't afraid to make changes. And he received a lot of criticism at the time, but I stood behind him. And as we evolved, we brought in new, strong leadership. And an interesting thing happened. All the old nattering nabobs of negativity from the other societies eventually retired or died out. And since the American Society of Retina Specialists had basically all members in our profession, the membership of of the three societies became almost identical over time, in that most of the members who are members of the Macula and the Retina Society now are also members of the American Society of Retina Specialists. So it was just a natural 40-year evolution. And if you wait long enough and you're patient, you know, that you can just about accomplish anything.
Now, let's talk a little bit about how your career has evolved. One of the things now you do is, in addition to writing articles for ASRS Retina Times and continue with your other activities, you have your own TV show. Tell us a little bit about that show.
Yeah, it's funny because now all my doctor friends want to know how they can get a TV show.
Right, right.
So when I in the late 90s, my wife and I had some serious and minor health problems, and we always loved coming to Aspen. As I said, it was actually the original meeting of the ASRS formation was in Aspen. And we decided to move to Aspen, and I decided to retire. And then you think you can ski and hike and bike and fly fish all day. That lasts about 2 weeks. And then, you know, because I had, at the time, I had the largest retina practice in the country with 17 offices in multiple states, when most people still had one or two offices. And I was running not only my clinical practice and my surgical practice, but also this big company. And so I had great doctors who worked with me at the time, and they were perfectly capable of taking over the practice. So we moved to Aspen, and I like to write, as you know, and I actually had a column in the Aspen newspapers and would write a weekly column with observations about life and observations about medicine and observations about anything that I found interesting. Because of my column, I got invited on another guy's TV show, and that was about 20 years ago. And I came on once or twice as a guest, and the station manager said to me, "Everybody seems to like you better than him. Do you want your own show?" And that's how I evolved into my own television show, which has been a really wild ride for me. What's ironic is, after all the things I feel I was able to accomplish and do in ophthalmology and with my patients, I get more recognition for this stupid television show than anything I ever did in real life.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's a couple of interesting parts to that. I think one of the things I've encountered even early in my career, which you didn't think would happen to you in your pre-medicine career, is you kind of end up in the medical bubble, where you know things that, I mean, obviously we take very important care of people, but like things and people who seem really important in the scope of your field, or in the, even, you know, within retina, for example. No, those relationships are still important, but like the overall importance to ophthalmologists, and then take you out to the doctors, and then to the layperson is less, right? Like there's a whole world of things that's going on, and sometimes we can lose sight of that. So I think it's interesting. The TV show probably gives you an opportunity to hopefully be also engaged in, you know, and not be as disconnected as some of us are from like the what's going on outside and how patients perceive us and medical issues are perceived by the layperson. It's probably a lot more important from the number of people who are tuning in or thinking about it than, you know, just, you know, the couple thousand retina specialists who are thinking about it in here in the United States. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. You know, what's interesting to me, Jay, is that the every doctor listening to this broadcast right now has many talents. And I would tell them, we've been so focused in this career track to be successful in college and medical school and internship and residency and fellowship and then academic careers or clinical careers. We've been so focused that most of us have never really had a chance to explore our other skills and talents and capabilities. And by example, I'm certain that every doctor listening to this has some other passion besides medicine, whether it's playing an instrument or whatever it might be, but they will never have the chance to experience that unless they broaden their horizons. And in our own specialty, three examples, not just me with my television show, but Howard Schatz, who was a very well-renowned retina specialist back in the 70s and early 80s, is now one of the most famous photographers in the world. Al Verne, my co-fellow who just, my co-resident who just retired, is now studying acting. And I went to some acting classes with him, and he's really good. So, so everyone here, I encourage you that I learned years ago from one of my attendings. He said, never confuse your profession with your life.
Yes.
They're two different things. They tend to sort of blend together in our minds into one thing, but your profession is your profession. And then you also have your life, your wife, your family, your children, your parents, your interests, and they are parallel to each other, but they're not mutually exclusive.
Well, that's great advice. I mean, I'll just end, you know, again, we talked about your very vast kind of an interesting experience in terms of the variety of things you've been participated in, whether it's starting an organization, the TV show, and then, of course, your career as a retina specialist and educator. I mean, we have a lot of fellows who listen to the program who are coming out. It's a different era, but maybe some of the same principles apply. So let's say you had a mentee, or let's say it was one of your children who was becoming a retina specialist. They're going to graduate in July. What would be the biggest piece of advice you would give them? Would it be that about profession versus life and passion? Would it be something else? What would be the takeaway that you would say from your 40 years plus of experience?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I have two children, David, who's an attorney, and Rachel, who's a real estate developer. Neither one of them wanted to go into medicine. And the reason was they didn't want to work that hard. They saw how hard we work in medicine, because medicine is a very jealous mistress. And you can't like do it part-time or half-time. If you want to be great at it, and everybody listening to this wants to be great, or they didn't get to get a residency in ophthalmology and a fellowship, if you want to be great at it, you have to give it, you know, like 110% effort. So I would tell anybody to encourage their children to go into medicine, to become an ophthalmologist, to become a retina specialist or a cornea specialist or whatever interests them, but to tell them that the rewards you get from medicine, despite all the negativity that we hear from many of our colleagues these days about the EMR and reimbursement and the regulations and HIPAA, the rewards we get from medicine are better than any other profession, and I would do it again 100 times in a row.
Well, Dr. Bovino, thanks so much for joining us. It's exciting to talk to you. I'm looking forward to this for a long time, and our listeners will appreciate it too, because very unique insights and good lessons for all of us. So thanks for your time, and again, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jay. I enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 156 episodes archived and sorted by category on the website. You'll also find our blog, which has a relatively new feature where you'll see reflections on the latest episodes each week. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list. That will get you updates on the most recent episodes as they come out. Alternatively, you can subscribe in the Apple Podcast or Android store, and then you'll get updates on your phone each time an episode comes out. You can like our Facebook page or find us on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can always contact us. There's a contact us link on our website, or you can directly email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback is super important to what we do so we can get better and deliver informational pieces that help you and what you want to hear. So we appreciate anyone who gives us feedback, and anyone who subscribes in the Apple Store or Android Store, please leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Jerry Bovino for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benacosta, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.